Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kershaw podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is my guest, or he might be a thief who was crucified. I can't tell anymore. It's Joel.
Wait, I'm a guest now?
Oh, I said guest. Co-host.
Hey.
Wow, demoted.
I mean, it's like you're insinuating that I'm not actually me, that I'm like, you know, just pretending to me or something
just
like that,
double.
Which is, you know, that's not the case. I'm definitely, me and Joel definitely didn't die.
I believe it. That sounds believable.
So, what's going on?
So, there's a third voice here. It's, Ms. Lindsay Busco, formerly of, Forgotten Failures.
Yep.
A fun podcast I guested on. And yep. She recorded Joel on.
As if, yeah.
Yep.
Hello, how are things?
things are good. I mean, I took maybe like 3 separate naps today, so mm-hmm. Can't complain.
Did I. Two for the movie and one for right afterwards.
Nice, yeah.
But that's awesome. Anyway, so we watched Kagamusha from 1980. It's Kurosawa's 27th film. It was produced by George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola.
Mm-hmm.
And they are huge Kurosawa fans, and by the late 70s they had enough power in Hollywood to be like, hey, let's give our hero some money to make a movie. And this is that movie.
Well, it certainly has a big production value. You can tell that there's a shitload of extras. There's lots of costuming. It's got a lot of. Did I mention extras? I'm sorry. This was kind of a big empty shell for me, and I feel bad. Like, I remember seeing. Like, I think the most famous images are just from that single part of this movie where our protagonist has a dream sequence, right?
Yeah.
And the colors are all painterly, and one person's in this, you know, the armor you might think of when you think of samurai armor. But the rest of the movie was not. Every other Kurosawa movie we've watched from before, I feel like we got a good hold on what kind of people were being represented in the movie, like actual characters. Mm-hmm. And in this one, the entire point of the movie was that the person was replacing somebody who had just passed away and therefore had to pretend to be that character. So I don't know if that made a whole, you know, issue with developing what was supposed to be going on, but I didn't really dig it.
I had the same reaction, but then I read some reviews from Ebert and the New York Times reviewer at the time, Vincent Canby, and they dissected it in like a film theory way, and I appreciate it a lot more reading their reviews now. But also, it's just a gorgeous film. Like, I can't stop thinking about just how colorful it is under the use of certain colors and scenes.
Yeah, it is beautiful, but it was a slog. Like, it when I looked at the runtime, I was not expecting too much. I was like, this is going to have a lot of not interesting parts. And it did. And also, you're completely right about, like, the characters. Like, it wasn't really, it didn't take an interesting angle with an interesting, you know, concept. It just took, everything was kind of too easy, and no character had to really struggle at any point, and you didn't really get to care about anybody on any level. It was very surface level. And even though it was beautiful, like, the shots were beautiful, and it was grand, like, the production value was, like, there. It just, I don't know, it didn't hit with me. Even though it was pretty look like, especially that nightmare sequence, that was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that felt like a throwback to Stalker, like Tarkovsky.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, of course, I was a huge movie fan, so I can see how that could even happen, but.
Yeah. Well, to me, that nightmare sequence reminded me of his other film, Dordeskaden. From 1970.
We haven't watched that movie.
Well, I've seen that movie, and certain aspects of this, like, It's like their Deskaden, but not as interesting as that movie is. And that movie has a... It's 2.5 hours, but there's this one shot towards the end that kind of makes it worth it, because it's being built up this whole time. Anyways, we'll get to that later.
Yeah. Well, you've sold me.
I will say I like that that scene towards the beginning where that messenger is running through like those groups of the sleeping and like dead soldiers and everything. That was done really well. And it reminded me of, you know, that scene in Gone with the Wind where they're following Scarlett O'Hara and they start panning out, like they zoom out and you get kind of the gravity of it and you get that grand scale production of like, oh, wow, this is a lot of people. That was really cool. I enjoyed the way that they did that. And I wish they would have done, I don't know, maybe they did a good job with the soldiers, I think. Like, I love the amount of, like, waiting around that they did, like, sitting and waiting for something to happen. That was great. And their costuming, of course, was, like, gorgeous. It was really good. But, like, the battle scenes were a bit muddy, and not interesting. Though I've never really been like a battle scene person. It's never been like my thing, to be fair. Yeah, other than sneaking into the room to like open that jar, he didn't really do anything that was like, it seemed like it was his choice. You know what I mean? Like, he was really just doing what everybody around him told him to. He didn't seem to have like agency in any real way.
I don't know, like, I must say, as I appreciate it on a deeper level through Ebert and other people talk about it, I'm kind of conflicted, because I see your guys' points, I understand where you guys are coming from, but I also am, I'm still not sure how to fully...
Do you have an excerpt from, like, the eBay, or the eBay?
I love those eBay reviews, though.
Yeah, the eBay auction that you won the DVD on, the Ebert review or anything like
that? Like how... I didn't want to write down a total review, but he broke it down in a very intelligent way that I didn't really see it at, because I didn't go to film school, so I don't know that stuff.
See the problem with the end scene there, where everybody's dead in the field, like all this like thing that they've been holding for 3 years, which I didn't really was three. It had been 3 years until somebody was like, "Oh, it's been almost 3 years already." Like, yeah. What the hell?
Yeah, time's kind of weird in this movie.
Yeah. But, like, yeah, we see all these, you know, the different clan members dead. I hesitate to say clan members, but that's what they are. They're members of a clan.
Yep.
Well, in a different context.
And, yeah, they're, like, the different colored armor from all, you know, the forest clan and the wind clan and the water clan, or fire clan, all out there dead. But I didn't feel like... this was an earned situation, especially since it was basically telegraphed that was going to happen because his, you know, the dead Daimyo's son was so ready to go kill something, he didn't care.
Like, I saw it as they didn't want to... Okay, what I gathered from the review, like, from what I read, is that Kurosawa was trying to kind of a whole lot of things all at once, and it kind of didn't really work fully.
And like
it feels that way. Yeah.
At the time, it got some meter. It was kind of received like The Shining was at the time where people were like, it's okay. But later on, it got reevaluated. And now it's considered a classic, but I still think he's done better things. But in terms of sheer scale, this is just like the big epics. This is the best big epic things for just pure filmmaking I've seen.
I can agree with that. Like, the scale was incredibly impressive throughout.
I mean, what are you comparing it to epic wise?
Like, when I say epic, I mean something like Lord of the Rings or Spartacus or Patton, you know, like this, you know, stuff like that.
So, and nothing I've seen, I mean, except for Lord of the Rings, but, Lord of the Rings does itself a favor by it, you know, keeping the focus small at first and then expanding out.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but they're really boring and stupid.
that. See, here's one of the problems with this movie. Yeah, your opinion on movies are incorrect constantly. It doesn't matter. Anyways, here's one of the problems.
Hey, let me explain why I don't like fantasy movies.
No, that's okay. Watch a little movie called Hawk the Slayer and then get back to me. Like I said, there's no development of the characters, right? Mm-hmm. But the showed somebody who I was like, oh shit, I want to know what this guy's up to. And that's the guy who plays Nobunaga?
Yes, yes.
He rides by on his horse, you know, and he's talking about that stuff. And the funny thing is, from playing video games for the last 25 years, I'm like, hey, that must be Nobunaga. I know what that guy looks like.
Yeah, like both of those, Nobunaga and also the thief, like, they both have backstories that would be interesting. And they both have, like, that they should have incentives of their own that would make them more interesting. Like, they showed it a little bit with the thief and opening the jar, but, like, they don't really go into why they're doing the things they're doing or wanting the things that they want. And that's what feels like is missing, is just that, why are these people doing this? It's just, I don't know. It, like Joel said, it's hollow. That's what it feels like.
It feels like the new Blade Runner. It's like, it's beautiful, but kind of not much to chew on.
Yeah, except I wasn't bored with the new Blade Runner. We talked about that off mic, that like I do feel like it is kind of hollow, but I still feel like I was fascinated the whole time. I just, upon reflection, realized that the story wasn't the interesting part of the movie. It's the world that, like, the story takes place in. And this, like, I've seen this, you know, this time period. I've seen these people and these actions, you know, in Kurosawa movies that were amazing. You know, I kept thinking, like, oh, let's get into some Seven Samurai here. Let's get into some Hidden Fortress here. Let's get into, you know, anything right there. But it's, like, those battle scenes, they felt... Maybe they felt like the way actual battles feel, boring. I'm not sure.
Chaotic and boring. Sure.
Yeah.
I will say I wish they went more into. I love that little group of spies. They were great in those little short kimonos. Woo! That was the very much appreciated that.
So this is based off historical people, and all the characters really did exist. And I think part of the problem was Kurosawa played too close to history a bit. Because, like, it's kind of, like, exactly what happened. And it was this big turning point for Japanese history. But it's kind of, like, it's a movie. You can kind of change some stuff.
He didn't inject any of that based on.
Yeah, like, do what Tarantino did with Inglourious Basterds. You can change the history of stuff and make it into something different.
I mean, that's the whole concept behind, like, a video game like Samurai Warriors or something like that, right? But once again, I think you feel... the reason Inglourious Basterds worked is because we've got a small, tight-knit group of characters that at first weren't even associated with each other, and then they all come crashing together. Mm-hmm. Like, who stands out as a character here? I think the old man that, like, was, I don't know, his the Fire Clan or whatever. You know, it's like Avatar. But
the Firebenders.
Yeah, like, I liked him, especially when he got really, you know, passionate about what are you saying, because his face turned bright red. Mm-hmm. I can't really tell you anything about him.
Yeah, the son-in-law, too, I wish had more to do with the story. Like, he was in it very little, but he had, like, real incentive, and he had motive, and he was trying to do things, at least.
Yeah, and they kept doing these, like, parlor scenes between him and... this other character who I have no idea who he was, but he was going like, no, your father wanted you to do this.
Yeah, like, who the hell? Yeah.
Now drink this potion. No, he didn't do that. But, you know, it's like this guy's twirling his mustache to get, you know, the son or son-in-law or whatever fired up.
Yeah.
And it just didn't fit with the rest of the movie.
No. No, it really didn't. Like, it's almost like he should have chosen a story to tell, like someone's story. it was just too wide on everybody.
Yeah, like, I know Kurosawa has had issues with studios having to cut down movies. Like, there's one movie he did that was 5.5 hours long that he cut down to 2 hours, 45 minutes. And this feels like a situation of, I bet this was like a 4-hour epic that he was forced to cut down.
Well, that's too bad.
It just feels like there's this a whole bunch of stuff missing in terms of like storylines. Like he wanted to do, make him like a two-parter, but studios were like, no, we don't do that anymore. It's the '80s.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's what he does.
Well, yeah.
He takes he takes as much time as he needs to tell the story, and it comes out like a Kurosawa movie. It comes out amazing. So when you cut him at the knees like that, I gave him a bigger budget and all this stuff like that. But
part of the problem was it was a Toho production and Fox production. So I think maybe working with two studios in two different countries may have contributed to kind of the, like off feeling of it compared to other work.
Well, they also got a terrible person doing the music.
Oh yeah,
I really did not enjoy that.
I like some of the score, like half the score what I liked, and half was like, does it feel like bad Rockford File music? Like there's a couple tracks in particular, it feels like I heard on like a 70s TV show.
Yeah. There's a part where let's call him, what is his actual Nobukaru, right? The guy who's taking his place, Nobukaru is his brother. Yeah. Shingen, the double is like they're returning back to the place where they live for the first time. And, you know, people are like sweeping the dirt on the, you know, anticipation of coming in, and everybody's lined up. And as the horses finally come into view, all of a sudden you start hearing these like trumpets playing, like it's an American military, you know, coming in. It's like, I don't think that's what it would sound like. And that has never been a problem before in a Kurosawa movie.
Do you think that maybe that was Fox interluding, be like, maybe like, do more American music, possibly.
Like we need something, you know, to show that the conquering hero has returned, and I'm not digging this, you know. I don't even know what like flute.
So there's a real interesting crew people. One is Ishiro Honda. He directed Gojira in 1954. He was a second unit director, and the production designer worked with Kurosawa from 1955 to 1991. So it was standard production, which is really good. But I was surprised to see the Godzilla guy kind of end up taking a back seat.
So you're saying this movie is as good as Godzilla? Is that what I wasn't hearing?
I don't know. I found it interesting that, like, that guy's career kind of turned into. Now it's just a second unit guy.
Yeah. Well, that's... I mean, Kurosawa wanted to do a Godzilla movie for most of his life, so you think that he probably was had that guy on so that he could talk about Godzilla all the time or something.
That's an in for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, Godzilla's still going strong by then.
Yep. Toho's like, no, you don't do those kinds of movies. Like, but I want to. Nope. Yeah.
Let's see, your father was in this.
Yeah, I'm not
sure where.
He was the old man, wasn't he? What's my father's name again? I can't remember.
Takashi Shimura. Yeah, this is one of the tiny things.
That says Taguchi Yobui. Or Guibi? Guibu?
Something like that.
Cha-cha-cha. I can't see.
But he was a couple of years from his death at this point.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thanks for bringing up my father's death. Great.
No, but I like that Kurosawa threw him a bone at this point, because he kind of slowed down at this point because he was kind of dying.
Right.
Well, that'll do it. At this
point. The doctor.
Yeah, it's in the credits as Doctor, and it's the guy from one of the attempted rapists from Penn Fortress.
Hmm. That's all you remember them for, the attempted rape.
Well, listen, Penn Fortress, that kind of really sticks out.
I remember it for its throwing gold onto a big burning pyre and then later going to go get the melted gold.
I remember that, but I also remember the weird attempted sexual assault in that movie.
Oh, whatever. I'm just kidding.
It's weird. Let's admit it.
I mean, it's not weird for those characters. Those guys are scumbags.
Yeah, but for Kurosawa, kind of going to that, like, it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do that. I don't know. Is it worth going over the plot, really?
Oh, yeah. We can go over it real quick.
I feel like this might be the shortest episode.
Yeah, it feels like there's not, like, a whole lot. There's just not a lot that happened in the movie.
Yeah, like,
we did discuss like pretty much everything. I mean, the grandson's a super cutie. He got in that sick burn on his grandpa thief. That part where they introduce him to see if he buys it, and he says, "You're right. He has changed. I'm not afraid of him anymore." And he just fucking kills the whole room.
Yeah, Lindsay, I'm sorry. I got this. Picked this one for you.
Oh, no, it's fine. It was interesting to watch. I was thinking, like, throughout, like, is, like, you know, like, steampunk is a thing. Is, like, feudal Japan punk a thing? Like, do they, is that a, because it could very easily lend itself to.
I mean, I believe in that Zack Snyder Sucker Punch. I believe they did have, like, mechanical samurai robots.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, if it is a thing, the Ninja Turtles were pioneers in that.
So, okay, here's what happens in this movie. So we got this general guy, right? He's not the general. He's the Daimyo. He's the leader of this clan. And he has done so well that two other warlords have teamed up against him in order to keep him at bay and so that he doesn't take over the main capital of Japan, Kyoto. And he is... At the beginning of the movie presents the entire premise of what we're supposed to be seeing, which is that him and his brother are sitting in a dark room together and they're dressed identically. And with them is a third person who is also dressed the same as them. And his brother is telling him that, like, I found this man. He was a thief. They were going to crucify him. And I just noticed how much he looked like you. No one else could see what I saw. But as soon as we get him in the garb and we get his hair the way yours is, it's almost uncanny how much he does. And the Daimyo is like, yeah, that dude totally looks like me. They set up that there is now another double because the brother, like I said before, the brother sometimes doubles for.
Yeah, because they look a lot alike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do. And that was a problem for me at first, but eventually I was able to separate the two people. So they are trying to seize this one castle. And that's where that scene you were talking about, that's really cool, where this guy who is, like, covered with mud starts running down the staircase, and he runs by, you know, these soldiers all dressed in red, and they all start waking up, and then he runs past all these soldiers in blue and then green, and that's a super cool scene. I was almost expecting that guy, since he was, like, covered in mud and you couldn't tell what color his armor was, that he was going to be, like, an assassin or something.
In the 50s with, like, Seven Samurai and Penn Fortress, like, those are popcorn movies that are deep and can be enjoyed by anyone, where this is not really a popcorn movie. It's just kind of, like, feels like, I hate the term Oscar bait, but kind of feels like that.
Yeah.
And it was nominated for Best Foreign Film, which he had won twice already, but the other two movies were that he won for, or won for, were better.
Like, well, I could see that you gave it 4 out of 5 stars, so I think that you liked it.
Well, it's more because of the visuals, honestly.
Yeah.
It kept me entertained. Like, I kept watching it, like, captivated more, mostly by just the colors and the visuals and the cinematography.
I like the colors of the armor and mm-hmm. the banners and stuff like that, but it wasn't like blown away or anything like that. Like I said, that one scene is really awesome looking, and yeah. you know, he's running through those like the piles of sand there, and it like is literally a watercolor or whatever, you know, sky and with mountains in the background, and you know that the samurai inside the armor, the daimo, is dead, so he's got that gross green look on him.
Yeah.
But everything else, yeah, it's nice looking. It isn't, you know, I didn't see like the color guard or anything like that. And there's even that one scene where he is at one of the, you know, the double is at one of those castles being sieged, and they...
I thought like some of the elements were cool. That hidden guard room bit. I was hoping that would go further into like a more James Bondy, like here are secret things available to you as the warlord. That would have been awesome. But yeah.
Like Yuzo Kurosawa is funnier.
I will say I was pulled out of it a little bit with some mm-hmm. of the banners, because that one diamond banner that was made up of like the four squares, mm-hmm. like I kept looking at it and seeing the like Windows 10 logo, and it really took me right out. I was like, no,
I saw a Triforce.
Yeah, one of them straight had the Triforce, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I feel like maybe
at this castle, they are trying to, they're apparently sieging it, and it's never been brought down before. They've been sieging it for months, and some of the clan are feeling like they, at this point, they should, like, you know, give in, because the military is getting tired, the leaders are getting tired, and the daimo decides that he wants to keep on, you know, pursuing, that they're almost done. They just need to hold on, because he is the mountain.
Yes.
And the mountain is unmovable, or something like that.
He's the original of the mountain.
He is the hound.
Yeah, his brother the hound.
And yeah, he scarred his brother's face. That's crazy. But their legend tells of a, that's what it sounds like. Every night a person plays the flute. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the men around from the opposing side are starting to, you know, look forward to that sound. But the daimo says, as soon as a night comes where that flute doesn't play, that is when we will take that castle. And he decides, I want to go tonight and hear the flute myself. So they set it up for him. And I don't believe we see him actually like get set up so that he could start listening and hearing this flute. We hear the flute playing, and then the opposing soldiers all, you know, kind of wake up so they can listen to this for a little bit. And we hear the flute for a little bit, and then suddenly from off screen there's a gunshot. Mm-hmm. Single gunshot, and everyone's freaking out, and you know what that means. The one night the daimo decides to go out, somebody spots him from a little window and just snipes him. And that guy was a good shooter. Later they've got like a little pine tree where he said he shot the daimo. Bam, he shoots that pine tree, no problem.
Yeah. I'm not trying to be a history irritating asshole, but muskets are not that accurate.
Well.
It's movie magic.
I mean, it's not. Isn't a musket more like a shotgun that fires like multiple rounds? I mean, this seems more like a rifle.
Yeah, but rifling wasn't a technique for guns at the time yet. That would develop later on. Rifling is just like a lining within the gun barrel, so it spins, so it's accurate. Whereas it's a smooth barrel, it just goes where it goes.
That's it. Get George Lucas on the phone. So the daimo's taking a bullet into his... It seems like he's taken it into his arm, but either way, it's not looking good for him. And they are... His advisors are sorry, his advisors are trying to figure out what they should do if he passes away, and the Daimyo says that if I pass away, don't want anyone to know for 3 years. And during that time, I want us to pull out from this war. I don't want to take Kyoto if I die from this wound. You know, I've already gotten over the fact that my banners are never going to be raised there. Right? He's being really humble about it. And he dies. They immediately go into trying to get the double to take his place, because people know that the Daimyo has a double that usually rides around, and they pretty much know that it's his brother. So they can tell him apart, but there's these spies that are looking, trying to figure out whether or not he got a fatal wound or not. And at first the double wants nothing to do with this. And they're not telling him what is going on. They won't tell him if the Daimyo's dead or not, or if he's just taking, you know, his place for a moment. And then one fateful night, while everyone is asleep, the thief here, the double guy, sneaks into the room where there's a big old clay pot. Now, the reason I knew what it was is because that movie, the latest Scorsese movie about the Spanish or the Portuguese priest that go to Japan.
Silence?
Yeah, Silence. At the, you know, spoiler for that movie, but the end, one of the characters is in one of those pots. So I was like, that's a burial pot, dude. But he didn't seem to know. Plus, he didn't know that the Daimyo was dead, so he didn't know what it was. He just, like, started breaking it open, and part of it said, like, I can't remember, like, linen, and the other part said treasure. So I guess he thought there must be treasure in there. But once he got it cracked open enough, sure enough, the Daimyo's dead face is looking right at him. Yeah, I like that part. That was a good part. Yeah.
Yeah, his like kind of pickled face.
Yeah. And that's cool, like breaking open the jar. That's a crazy way to discover that.
Yeah,
it was
shocking.
That, like,
yeah.
Yeah. And this is where he says straight out, I'm not going to do this. I thought, you know, like, you want me to take over this man's life if he's dead, and I don't want to sacrifice my life. So he runs off, and the rest of the clansmen there, I don't like saying that, the rest of the clan guys, what are they?
It's a different context.
I know.
Clan means something different to them.
But it's,
it's spelled with a C.
Listen, if somebody told you they were in the clan right now, what would you
think? I'd ask what type.
What type? You mean one of those Japanese ones or the racist kind?
if it's historical anyway, then I know it means it's like a family with money, essentially.
Mm. Also, the two are not mutually exclusive. Let's not rule that out.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I just remembered I was in a Team Fortress Classic clan when I was in high school.
Oh, nice.
So, didn't occur to me at the time that was weird. Anyway, the advisors basically decide that they're going to just let everyone know that the Daimyo's dead, because there's no way they're going to be pulling it off without the double involved. Mm-hmm. So they take his body out to the lake that he wanted to be buried in. And the double witnesses this whole thing. They leave, you know, his funeral pot in the water, come back out of the mist without it. All the while, these spies are like, what was in that jar? What did they take in there? You know, is the Daimyo? Or is it treasure? That doesn't make any sense. Why would they take treasure out there?
Yeah, and the one has netting over his face for some reason.
Well, that was the double. The double, like, was hiding in that same ship that they walked into.
Really?
Yeah, and they didn't notice him for some reason. At this point, the double decides that he wants to honor his dead lord by taking over his place for them. So he shows up in a bunch of situations where he would, like, riding his horse, riding by the soldiers to show that he's there. making an entrance. They have political or strategy meetings where he sits and he doesn't say anything. The whole time the brother is coaching him on what to do and what not to do. Mm-hmm. The grandson is a big part of his life. That scene is really cute when he first returns home. And yeah, the grandson's like, that's not him.
Yeah, kids say the darndest things, even in feudal Japan. They really do.
Give him a pudding pop.
Right.
No. Yeah, and what happens is, I think this was part of the whole progress of time there. We see him getting used to his home life there, the strategy meetings. Occasionally he does speak up in a way, and every time he does, the brother seems to be like delighted that he like spoke out of turn, because it's like, oh, that's like my old brother. Looks at the camera and smiles.
Yeah, wink.
And eventually somebody makes a move when they were purposely not making any moves against the opposing clans. It was because there's this whole thing where the Daimyo's son is not going to inherit anything. Mm-hmm. It's actually his son's son, the Daimyo's grandson, is going to be responsible once he's of age. And he's got a real bee in his bonnet about this. So he decides he's going to take this castle that nobody else has been able to take. And everyone's at first is kind of freaking out at it, you know. And they say, well, maybe he could take it. I mean, he's a military genius. He's done really good, but he didn't get permission before he did this thing. And they decide that they're going to help him by giving him a show of force and showing that the Daimyo is actually there. And so the double goes out there with his, you know, military guard and the other clans, and they stand on a hillside overlooking the castle and the battle. Now this is the part where I was talking about, like, they've spent tons of money on these kind of things. But this entire scene takes place with us watching the double on the hillside while things look like they're going downhill. These horses are running by, and people are like, are those good guys or bad guys? You know, like, I can't tell. They're not raising a flag. Oh, no, they're bad guys, you know. And then people are getting shot left and right. Once again, that sharpshooter. And eventually they're shooting people that are near where the double has been sitting, pretending to be the Daimyo. And people will stand directly in front of him and get shot, you know, for him to save this guy who got stuck in this situation. A troop of the enemy on horseback with their banners raised, running towards where the Daimyo is, or the double has been sitting, seeing that they're still standing there with their banners raised and deciding to retreat instead. And like, I don't know, it's, yeah.
Yeah, that's basically how it happened and what happened. Now, was that guy, was he the Shingen's son or son-in-law? Because I thought the grandson's mother was his daughter. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I don't know what the story, like,
I mean, it was very weak, like how they set it up. It was very weak either way.
They just said it real quick. Like, he conquered the castle, and then he took the castle, whatever person's wife, and then they had a child, but the child was illegitimate, but the grandchild, for some reason, is legitimate.
Yeah, and then pretend for a second that I am not a discerning movie viewer. what was the 3-year thing for? Like, why was it? I didn't understand why 3 years. Like, what that? Like, did they need that kind of recovery time to then go and fight? I don't know why it was such a specific time frame that he asked for him to fake alive
for a movie just following what happened in history.
Okay,
but then it doesn't really give much of a reason. Like, or maybe, like, it's not really recorded why exactly he picked 3 years. I don't know. I don't know the exact details.
But yeah, maybe. I wonder if just like historically that's how long they got away with it, because that seems more like how that happened. But yeah, it just it seemed weird to me for that to be like a deathbed wish.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, I'm looking at the at least the Wikipedia article, and it doesn't divulge why that was his particular order, but I don't, it's just one of those things. But, okay, so that battle happens, they end up winning the day, but the son or son-in-law or whoever he is not satisfied, because rather than getting the glory for taking the lead and winning the battles, once again, his father gets the credit, even though he knows that his father is dead. So it's as if this double is like purposely rubbing this thing into his face. Like, from beyond the grave, his father is still ruling over everything he does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just setting, like, what's going to end up happening towards the end of the movie. Like, I skipped over a whole chunk of stuff that happens because it's not... You can't really describe. It's a lot of the advisors talking, the generals talking, you know, the double playing with the grandson. They become extremely close. And, yeah, just, like, I'm already winding up to, like, towards the end, because after that battle... Well, see, one of the interesting things that happens is we do occasionally see the other side, where the two other leaders of the clans either talk to each other or they have people talking to them about what the main daimyo has been up to.
Yeah.
And they keep talking about how they feel in their guts that he died, but that it's... Eventually Nobunaga's like... It's just the feeling of, like, the future victory we're going to have. It's like we can't help but know that in our hearts he is dead. And this is the destiny that we're going to reach. There's this part where Nobunaga...
Like, it feels... some reviews brought up it feels like a Shakespeare. And Kurosawa's favorite writers were Shakespeare and... I was saying wrong.
Dostoevsky.
Yes, the idiot and Brothers Karamazov, that guy.
And Chuck Palahniuk.
Sure. But
yeah, he really took a lot from Diary on this one, for sure.
Yep, he loved Invisible Monsters.
Yeah, but still, like, even...
It feels like his attempt at trying to do Shakespeare, that didn't really work. But yeah. His next movie was a direct adaptation of Shakespeare.
Yeah, it fell flat at that. Just because, I know I've said this a bunch of different ways, but like, just there's no reason for anybody to do the things that they're doing. Like, none given. Like, there's no one seems invested.
They're not preventing. They're not allowing us to be invested. Is the problem?
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, there's like, they're not giving any like good enough incentive for anybody. Like, no one has clear motive. Even when they show like the other guys who are fighting back, like, I mean, obviously they're fighting because they're fighting, but
right,
like, I don't know, like, it just it falls flat with characters and incentive,
which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see, like, this possibly 4.5-hour cut. Like, I know that sounds silly when I'm being so down on this movie, mm-hmm. but like, I have a feeling that Kurosawa had a bunch of stuff that they just cut out because they're like, we don't need character development. This is a historical drama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, given this, the production and that he was 70 at the time, it's incredible. But aside from the age factor, it's kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah, I will certainly not produce anything like that at 70. Or at 31, or like or any time between then, like it is impressive that way.
Like, George Miller made Fury Road, and he was 70. He was surprisingly old when he did Fury Road, which makes the movie even better.
Now, I want to talk about this Nobunaga scene. I keep trying to bring up, and I keep getting distracted. Nobunaga's on his horse. He's walking along, and he's talking to somebody about the other daimyo. And he stops and he looks up, you know, to this this wall. And at the top of this wall, there's two Jesuit priests, and they say something in Latin, mm-hmm. and they do the sign of the cross, like they're blessing him, and he says very loudly, "Amen." And I was like, I want to follow this guy around. This guy is fascinating. What's going on? Like,
yeah, the brother. About time. The brother was just so. We needed more background on him. We needed more backstory.
Yeah, like,
because he had seen things. He had experienced life.
Like, there are so many hints of things like the clash of religion and the clash of like technology. Because the one other clan was using guns. Far more than the one we were following, and there's all this like stuff with class, but it's like it's just hints of like a hint of an epic story when there's no epic story to be told.
I mean, there is an epic story. They chose to tell. It's like he was trying to tell the little story about this, the Kagemusha, which is like the term for a double for a person in a high up position. But they also tried to focus on the wider world, and that's where it came apart at the seams. Like, if he had focused on this guy, although something else I didn't like is that in the beginning when this guy was getting used to having to pretend to be the Daimyo in this position, it felt like they were trying to do a comedy of errors thing.
Yeah, a mm-hmm. little bit.
And some of it was silly.
Yeah.
And some of it was like...
It mostly feels like lifted from like a textbook that just lists like the dates, like the battles, and like just all the surface stuff, and gives no like stakes or like no like, gravity to it.
Like, it shows he like it feels like he just found this piece of history that he was obsessed with, but like maybe no one was like overlooking what he was doing in terms of like the script. Mm-hmm. Like, they let him just go for it, where it's like, no, there should be people that
What this movie could really use is just get Tarantino in there, punch up the dialogue,
and yeah,
there you go, perfect movie.
Exactly. Well, I don't know why these samurai keep saying the N-word, but hey.
I'll take it.
It's a movie. Yeah, okay, so like I said, we're winding down at this point. Mm-hmm. The double decides to ride on this horse that he has been basically forbidden from doing because they keep telling everybody, oh, he's injured, he can't ride a horse. Oh, he's injured, he can't have sex with these prostitutes or whatever.
Well, that's I had, like, real anxiety when he first, like, you know, was hanging out with those women.
The mistresses.
And I was like, oh, my God, like, it would suck to live in a world where, like, you have access to these women, but you can't, like... You don't know if your penis is the same as these girls would know. They would know that. Like, that would be absolutely like agonizing to not be able to be found out that way.
The funny thing about that scene is he recognizes the situation. He's like, okay, this is never going to work. And I definitely want to sleep with these girls.
Yes.
So I'm just going to tell them the truth. We're going to have to deal with it right here.
Yeah.
And then it's going to happen. But obviously, it did not happen.
No.
Because when our double gets thrown off this horse inevitably, because it cannot be conquered.
Except by the dead leader.
Except for, yep, he was the only one who could win that horse's heart. And he gets pulled off, you know, out of the ground. He's injured, and his two mistresses are over there. And they're trying to look at his injury, so they remove part of his robe, and oh my gosh, he doesn't have the scar that he received at that. They know exactly which battle it is. Battle of blah, blah, blah. This isn't him. This is a double. And, you know, they're yelling it to everybody, so the jig is up. Mm-hmm. Now, his brother was right there, too, and the look on his brother's face is like, I fucked up. Yeah. So, yeah.
He get the double gets kicked out, and then the son decide to take control, and it's a big, which I, on paper, it's interesting because, like, the big climactic battle was anticlimactic.
Right. And it's based on a real battle.
Yeah. Where, like, the one side was using modern technology, one wasn't, and they knew they knew they were going to die, but they kept going anyways. That's the least, you know. It's a Japanese thing.
It's honor. In honorable way, yeah, to go.
Yeah, I feel like a bunch of Yakuza movies that end with, like, the hero we're following, not hero, but the person we're following in, like, a last-ditch effort gets killed in the end. In the double, he's watching the battle, and he gets involved because he feels he's a part of the clan again, and he dies and just floats off.
Yep.
Yeah.
I do feel like if you wanted to go ahead and make a spinoff that was just, like, based on the story of Nobukato, you would take that moment where he realizes he fucked up in that horse scene, and then record scratch. You're probably wondering how I got here.
As he's getting thrown in the air.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, Joel, is there anything to really talk about this with Hunter in the Dark?
Yes, there is. I was specifically thinking about this. Now, Hunter in the Dark is a kind of a samurai movie. I think it takes place during a different period, possibly.
About 200 years later.
Okay, yeah. So, but it's more like almost more like a gangster movie.
Yeah,
and it's sleazy. It's violent. It's dark, and, you know, at the end we get this basically the same ending here, where, like, oh, everybody's that we could care about is dead,
and both feature Nakadai in a starring role.
Yep, and I feel like if this movie didn't do as well in Japan as Hunter in the Dark, I wouldn't have been surprised. Like, I feel like more movies were leaning towards that kind of, you know, I mean, it's almost Grindhouse what we watched, especially compared to this. This felt like tame, you know, like, you know, maybe chocolate milk. They put some chocolate in there to spice it up.
Yeah, Kurosawa never went that extreme. He was usually, like, you know, made, like, popcorn, not popcorn movies, but movies that could appreciate sure everyone.
I mean, you say that, but I feel like even compared to Hidden Fortress, you know, Hidden Fortress is like a hell of a fun ride, exciting, you know, thing. It's got lots of intrigue and people pretending not to be other people and violence.
I'm not saying this is a popcorn movie. Like,
I'm saying
capable of.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. He's capable, and that's why I find it so disappointing.
And, like, even like Rhapsody in August feels like. Like that, because that's a very universal, like the very universal. Where this is kind of too specific.
Mm-hmm. And there was one other Japanese movie that we could find that came out in 1980. Have you seen that other one?
What was it?
It was. You said it was like Lone Wolf and Cub, but it was like from a series, and they smashed together the episodes into a movie.
Yeah. Shogun Assassin.
Yeah, there it is.
The first three movies, and then it added like a synthy 80s techno soundtrack to it. And yeah, I didn't want to watch that.
Yeah, and that sounds like it's way more like what we watched last week. I'm looking at a review from Matt Brady here. It says, nonstop orgy of bloodletting. Oh, yeah. Sounds like a movie I need to see. And tons of high-pressure gore spraying. Spencer, why didn't we watch this movie?
Because I didn't want to watch it. I want to watch the real movies.
God damn it. Anyway.
You can watch it.
I will.
I want you to butcher the Americanized version.
Well, it says here it was just two movies that were smashed together.
Well, still, I want to see the real Lone Wolf and Cub.
Only the 85 minutes. Oh, man. Anyway, I think it is actually a pretty good comparison, even though the themes don't match. It's what is so different about them that makes them interesting. It's like you can feel the American influence in Kagemusha that is obviously not there in Hunter in the Dark. It's like they were worried about making a movie acceptable for general audiences. Or, like you said before, possibly Oscar bait.
Which is even more disappointing given the last movie was Daresu Ozawa.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah, and that's also a pretty tame movie. Like, there isn't... That's not an action movie for any anyway, but the characters are so interesting that you get sucked in. And that's... Speaking of beautiful colors, like, if I had to pick a movie to represent the beautiful palette that Kurosawa would have had access to, I'll pick that movie over Kagemusha.
Interesting in different ways.
What I'm saying is, Kagemusha, two thumbs up. No, I'm just kidding.
I think if you're a Kurosawa completist, it's worth watching.
Yeah.
But only if you're complete. Like, I'd never seen it. I just only heard that it was, like Ebert loved it, and it was, like, got a big reevaluation later on. It's supposed to be, like, great.
But then it's, like... And we should say that, like you said, on Letterboxd, this has an average rating of 4.0. So everyone that I'm looking at that, like, I follow on here gave it 5 or at least 4 stars.
Yeah, so, I gave it 4 stars pretty much just because of the visuals, and I never felt bored.
That would be a 6-star movie, or a 3-star movie for me.
Like, I mean, watch it again.
Wait, you didn't feel bored?
No.
That's funny.
It takes a lot for me to feel bored.
Uh-huh.
Like Peter Jackson, pretty much.
Oh, man.
I
fell asleep like 2 times in this movie.
Lord of the Rings are way, yeah.
No,
way more interesting.
Also, Dead Alive, get out of here.
I don't like goopy, oozy, like, body horror stuff.
You're a loss.
I hate Society. That movie made me want to vomit.
What?
He doesn't like good things, I told you.
I don't like, you're Reanimator, right, Joel. Either. See, I didn't believe you at first, but man,
you didn't like Reanimator. That movie's hilarious.
What?
I hate goopy, oozy, like gore like that. It makes me want to throw up. I hate it.
Is a strong word, Spencer.
I do. I hate as much as I hate. Like,
wait! Don't you like Italian horror?
It's
though?
Not goopy,
Giallo?
Oozy.
It is pretty goopy.
It's not goopy.
It's not oozy.
It's not wet like a Brian Yuzna movie. Those movies are just, like, wet and sweaty, and there's just, like, blood oozing. It's like, ugh.
Well, what about Deathbed?
It's sticky. What?
Deathbed, the bed that eats people?
Yeah, the bed that eats people.
Never seen it.
Me neither.
Oh, man.
I've only heard legend of it.
How about Slither? Slither, oh. the one by James Gunn.
I have the same reaction to it as I do a Fight Club, where every time I see it, every successive time I see it, I like it even less for some reason.
You heard it here first, folks. Fight Club and Slither are practically the same. No!
I used to love Fight Club. I can't finish it anymore. I get so irritated with it.
Eh.
For some reason. Same with Slither. I just find it annoying now because I've seen it like 10 times.
Let's talk about 1980.
Yeah, let's do it.
Did you find anything interesting in there?
Yeah. There were some movies at home really stood out. I will say number one, Animal Olympics, was a 1980 film, and I loved that shit as a kid. It was my super jam.
What the hell is that?
It's an animated film that Billy Crystal is in. And it's about animals being in the Olympics. It's about
I've heard of this.
Yeah, and it had it was the first instance of like a sexy cartoon woman, but it was a lion. It was very uncomfortable. Mm. I'm sure still
like
is today.
Robin Hood.
Yeah. She was uncomfortably sexy for a cartoon lion. They showed a lot of her running from the back. That was a little bit weird. It's a ride because it just cuts to, it's just like you're watching the Olympics, but they're animals competing.
Okay, I added that to my list. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to recommend it to anybody, but it's one that like I definitely.
So you're saying if you have kids, watch it with them?
I mean,
I don't think she was saying that.
Yeah, 1980s kids, maybe. Not sure if it's for our 2000s kids.
So you're saying kids should be watching the Minions instead of that?
Yeah, for sure. Sexy Minions instead.
Okay.
And also 9 to 5, which is another one of my jams. That's a one with Lily Tomlin. Yeah, Dolly Parton. Jane Fonda.
Yep.
And they're Daddy just Coleman. You know, working for a living.
Great. Wait, is a song from the movie?
No, she wrote that song for the movie.
Yeah, that was written for the movie, and it became its own thing.
In fact, she had never worked a 9-to-5 job before when she wrote that song.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Would she ever have to? Come on.
No. Obviously not.
I love the story of why she wears all the makeup and has the nails. Do you know why?
What's that?
When she was 5, her family went to the big city, well, the nearest city, and she saw a prostitute and thought she was beautiful. And her mom said, "Don't dress like that." And she said, "Too late."
Yeah, I mean, good on her. She's amazing. She looks amazing. She's looked amazing since ever. Yeah, like that. That was a good movie. Coal Miner's Daughter was one that I really appreciated growing up, even though it handled some sticky themes. That's one with was that Tommy Lee Jones was in that? Sissy Spacek.
Was he grumpy in that one too?
I mean, would you call like an abuser grumpy? I don't know. Like <that's>... it depends on your definition of someone who would be violent to their partner.
Yep. would you call grumpy an abuser? I'm talking about the dwarf.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a committed relationship, I would not be surprised to hear that grumpy was an abuser.
I don't know about dopey.
Yeah,
I think that's dopey is the sign. He didn't used to be dopey, and then he got smacked around.
Yeah. All right, Joel, you got that Star Wars movie, right? You're picking that.
Well, I can talk about it if you're not going to. I mean, you just said that you don't like things that are good, so
yeah.
I guess I can talk about it. So yeah, Empire Strikes Back, but everybody's seen that movie and loves it. So what I'd like to mention is another movie that I'm sure you would hate called Hawk the Slayer, 1980, directed by Terry Marcel.
I like the music from it.
Yeah, that's the best part. Yeah, it's got this funky kind of disco-y beat like adventure music, though. And the main character, everybody in it is just absolutely terrible. They're terrible at acting, and I don't know why they thought it was a good idea to release this movie, but it kind of is charmed into my heart because we watched it for Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space. So I've been cursed. But it's about a man with a sword that he says he can control with his mind, and it's basically like a D&D, the movie, because there's like a... And, and of course, one of the best things is that it has Jack Palance as the villain, and he's wearing this armor the whole time. This is Jack Palance we're talking about. He's in this fantasy movie. So, yeah, if you haven't seen it, you should watch it just for larfs.
Okay. The Shining, obviously.
Never heard of it.
It's pretty good. You should see it. It has Scatman Crothers.
That's a made-up word, The Shining.
No. Never mind. Okay, there's The Shining, and I haven't seen this movie.
Wait, what?
But
you always do this.
Yes, I know. I've seen pictures from the movie, and they delight me. But Can't Stop the Music, the Village People.
No. Musical. Don't.
Steve
Gutenberg. No.
I might have to watch that.
Don't.
And
no.
Is in it.
No. It's not even ironically funny.
You gotta see pictures from this movie. It's hilarious.
It's a stinkeroo.
Gutenberg.
I do also have to give a shout out to The Monster Club, which is just a delightful movie. It's with Vincent Price and Donald Pleasance. John Carradine's in it.
Actor.
It's an anthology. So, like, Vincent Price and Donald Pleasance are, like, in this monster club. It's like a bar. and they're sharing monster stories. And one of my favorite things in it is, I think Donald Pleasance goes into like this whole genealogy of monsters. Like, what was it? It's like if a vampire and a werewolf mate, they make a werevamp, like that, and so on and so forth. And at one point, they're like, "Yeah, if such and such and such and such mate, they make a Shamdoc, and the Shamdoc's the Shamdoc's power is it can whistle." Like it's, and they have a story based off that, and it's ridiculous. And at one point, while they're in the club, there's like a strip tease that goes on, and this woman just starts like taking her clothes off, and she takes all her clothes off until she's just a skeleton.
Oh, that sounds really good.
It's a treat. Like fun. It's one I would recommend that one for sure. It's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Airplane is from 1980.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody about that yesterday.
Do you like that movie, Joel? You've never seen The Jerk.
No, I've not seen The Jerk. I've seen Airplane, and it is very funny. Like, it holds up. I just watched it a couple of years ago, and I still thought there were very funny parts in it.
Yeah.
I like that movie. It's great. The sequel, not as good.
I did not see it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're fine.
Yeah. Dressed to Kill came out this year, 1980. That's a Brian De Palma movie. And I have to say that this movie is, like, beloved by some people. It is critically acclaimed, I think. And it's about a woman who is... I can't even remember now. That, like, there's a therapist played by Michael Caine. And there's a woman that at first... It pulls a psycho. Like, you think she's going to be the main character, and then she... It's not really a spoiler to say she gets offed in kind of a really gory way.
Is this the most obvious De Palma wanting to be Hitchcock movie?
It's definitely one of them. I don't know if it is the most, but it's definitely Psycho right up there. Yeah. Up until the point where there is a person, I don't want to spoil it, but they're yeah, you should see it. It's a little bit insensitive to certain things that are now like not something that you would be making a movie about, but yeah.
I listened to a podcast today that brought up that issue.
Yeah,
with that movie.
Yeah, mysterious tall blonde woman wearing sunglasses murders one of the psychiatrist's patients, and now she's after the prostitute who witnessed it. There we go. That's a good description without spoilers.
All right.
And, yeah, if you haven't watched it, you should watch it. Like, but somebody told me and Sarah that we would really enjoy it. And we sat down and watched it. And after we were done, we were like, what the fuck was that? I feel like somebody tricked us. But I still think it's worth watching.
Okay. And my last one is The Changeling. It's a George C. Scott horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that movie?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah, I used to. I think I still own it.
Okay.
Maybe, but it's that style of like 70s horror movie, kind of like The Shining, where it's a slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a guy who he's a college professor and he rents a house, and there's something odd about the house, and it has one of the most depressing openings to a movie. Where you see his family get killed?
His family is suddenly and quite dramatically killed. It's actually very funny.
Okay.
Sorry. It is very silly how it ends up, but yeah.
It's still tragic.
I think the movie should be watched. I think it's this is another one that people are like over the moon about, and I personally just found it to be interesting, not necessarily good.
Well, I thought it was great because I didn't hear anything about it before.
Oh, okay.
I just knew it was a movie.
Well, yeah, no, I didn't know anything about it either. I just knew that people said that it was like one of the best quote-unquote adult horror movies. You know, I think they call things that adult horror as opposed to teenagers being slashed to death. There are no teenagers being slashed to death in this movie.
No.
It's a really interesting ghost story. I think it's on par with The Shining.
No.
I do. Lindsay?
No. I'm going to call that one. That, no.
For me personally, it is. It is just, I find something about so compelling and slash comforting.
Understand. But you know what was as good as The Shining that came out in 1980?
Popeye with Shelley Duvall.
Friday the 13th. That's
exactly what I was
going to
say.
Oh, wait.
Popeye. Because we can't go and not mention Popeye, which was...
Yeah, starring super Hollywood babe Shelley Duvall.
Like a comedy now, body horror movie.
Now, why do people like that movie? Just kidding. I'm one of those people. I'm asking you, why do I like this movie? What the hell's wrong with
us? Duvall is super hot.
No, she, what? She is not.
Yeah, she is.
What the hell she's are you talking hot. About?
What?
You don't think she's hot?
I mean, she's striking. Yes.
You don't think... You guys are crazy.
I was so upset I just unplugged my earphones. What's going on? Okay.
I'm not alone.
I'm not
saying she's ugly or anything like that. No. I've never heard her described as hot.
Yeah, I've never thought of her as like hot. She's like, she's not ugly. For sure.
I
she has a presence.
Understand
but I've never
people.
Thought of her as like
she's
a
got those
body.
She's got those goldfish bowls where her eyes are supposed to be. I don't just kidding. I'm going to help. Bye.
I just don't think we have the same taste, Spencer.
Nah.
That's fine.
I bet she's put on set. Oh wait, you know what? You want to see a good no. Shelley Duvall movie? Go watch never mind.
Three Women.
No. Is she the one in Caveman?
No, that's Barbara Bach.
No, there's a different woman in that movie.
Oh.
Who has a much bigger role than Barbara Bach.
I don't know. I've never seen Caveman. A Ringo movie?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is Shelley Long.
Different person. Now that's a hot Shelley.
Yep.
Wait, that Troop Beverly Hills one?
Yes.
Okay.
So, let's see. The only other... I want to mention two real quick. Mm-hmm. The Elephant Man, David Lynch.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not like his other movies. Like, it's not weirdo symbolism. It's scary. It does have a little bit of a freakiness going on, but that's just based on the subject matter, which is... A man
probably
who
the most coherent.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a straight up biopic, yeah. You know, about John Merrick, who had facial deformity, and it's really well done. And the last one I want to mention is
that's produced by Mel Brooks.
That is correct. Yes, and he didn't want anyone to know that at first
because he thought people would assume it's a comedy.
Yeah. Same thing with The Fly.
Oh, yeah, I forgot you did that.
And the last one is Battle Beyond the Stars, which is a Corman-produced movie that recycles music from a different movie. Or, no, I'm sorry. Other movies recycle its music. And it is a total Star Wars ripoff, but it is so much fun that, like, I recommend it, with a group of friends and a couple of drinks. It's just a lot of fun. What, you don't like it?
I don't know. I've never seen it.
They don't say any weird words.
They're all Corman, real.
So it's Corman, so I'll probably give their shot.
All right. It has a ship that's shaped like a pair of boobs, except for when you're looking at it at the top, then it looks like fallopian tubes.
Oh. Is it a comedy?
No.
Oh.
It's not.
Okay. All right. So the next episode will be Rashomon with what's that guy's name? Predict the cast.
Josh Hollis?
Yeah, Josh Hollywood Hollis.
That's not the way I heard it.
It's Hollywood Hollis to me. Until he moves out Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be just be that movie because 1950, there's not much to pick from. And so that one, after it went off, it will be the one-year anniversary episode, which we will finally cover the movie High and Low.
Never heard of it.
You got to give the people what they want.
Yeah, and I'm working on getting some guests from The Pink Smoke, which is a movie review article site with some really good stuff on there.
Hmm.
And they also are for... okay, so, Lindsay, you got stuff to plug?
Do not.
You go listen to back episodes, right? Old episodes of...
That's true. Recently did Mike Ara from the Forgotten Failures podcast has a new podcast with his friends called Ranks for Nothing. And I recently did, I guested on an episode where we picked our favorite 90s horror films.
Cool.
And they're actually doing a whole thing where they're doing a decade with a guest or two on for each. And it's really good. It was a really fun talk. And we really got into it as 90s kids.
Did you talk about Doppelganger with Drew Barrymore?
No. I talked about Dr. Giggles. For sure.
rest in peace, Larry. No, what's the guy's name? Larry Drake.
Mm. Also talked to the People Under the Stairs, just a good one, and a bunch of others. But yeah, that I don't think is out yet. It's coming out soon if it hasn't come out yet. I think they just released like the 1980s episode. But yeah, I'll be in that either right now or coming up soon.
Yeah, this episode will come out October 30th.
Okay, maybe by then.
Yeah, and I like to say, if Jamie, my buddy Jamie, if you're listening, happy birthday. Apologize.
If not, fuck you. Oh, that's great.
Hey.
Happy death day.
I've known him over a decade. Old friend.
And you haven't told him fuck you yet? Like, that's...
that's like, yeah, you should get him a cake.
I'll be in Disney World.
Or possibly in Eclair, and you know what to put in it.
You know what to do.
Okay. I got some Knife Fight, old TV shows, horror science fiction. This month, I ruined this bad TV movie called Vampire. It's shitty. Don't bother watching it. But read my review, and read Gina's review on Tune In Tonight. It's really good, also. And for November 7 Knife Fight review, it's going to be The Stone Tape, which is a famous BBC TV movie that if you're British in like 40, you probably know what it is if you're not. And I was on Grindvent episode 74, talking about Coonskin, a movie I'm kind of obsessed with and work on a secret project on. Actually about that movie, and I was on School of Schlock episode 26 talking about Return of the Kung Fu Dragon, which is a very terrible but kind of interesting Kung Fu movie. That's for free on YouTube and archive.org, but there are two different versions. And there's a very distinct difference where, like, I think one has a character turn to a giant and stomp around a town, and the other version has a part cut out.
It sounds like you're... Yeah. Sounds like one is the good one.
No, neither is the good one. But, yeah, I listen to...
One is the less shitty one.
And a person turns to a horse, and it... like a pig demon who teleports. It sounds interesting, but it's not as good as you'd hope.
Yeah, that's too episode, bad.
Yeah, you could cover on your podcast. Episode 26, School of Sherlock, episode 74, Grindben, some of Knife Fight stuff. Joel, you have a space pod.
You say we cover it on our podcast, but I don't know why you would say that. Like, we only cover romantic comedies, so... On Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space.
Yeah, Space Pod.
The podcast space. That me and my friends Aaron and Sarah do together, which we talk about the latest romantic comedies, such as... okay, I can't follow through on this joke because I don't know any romantic comedies. It's a science fiction and fantasy movie podcast where we talk about movies where people have weird ears and they say words that aren't really words.
Most recently, we talked about Spirited Away and the most recent Alien movie, Alien Covenant. That episode is coming out on the 16th. And let's see, this is coming out on the 30th. So by then, we'll have Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie from the 90s.
Uh-oh. Oh, yeah.
And the
Paul Rubens.
Deadly Friend.
Yep. It's one of my favorite movies, and I don't care what anyone else thinks.
You shouldn't. It's better than the TV series.
Thank you. It's about time.
Yeah.
And also, we're going to have a special spooky episode for Halloween on The Gate. I think it's a slightly silly, but also kind of spooky, spook-em-up movie. I'm not sure. I don't know anything really about it. We'll see. Those are all available in the usual places: iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Apple Podcasts is what they call it now, Google.
Yeah. And listeners, tomorrow on October 31st, a super special episode is going to come out featuring Kill by Kill host Gina Radcliffe and Patrick Stewart Hamilton.
Oh, yeah?
Patrick Hamilton. Yeah. We talk about one of my favorite actors, James Hong.
Yep.
And how he's an erotic sex god.
It's a special crossover Kill by Kill High and Low podcast episode where we talk about a movie that doesn't quite fit in with either of our format, but hey, it's cool.
Yeah, it's a movie that two people on the episode like and other two don't.
You and Patrick. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you'll figure it out who likes what. Yeah, that's it. Listen to the tag for all the other information stuff.
Okay. Bye, listeners.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks a lot, Lindsay.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was fun.
Jeez, Joel. The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show is available on the Google Play Store, Podiant, PODIANT, Podbean, as bean, not beam, and iTunes, and wherever you find your podcast. Thank you for listening.
We who are young should now take a stand. Don't run from the burdens of women and men. Continue to give, continue to live for what you know is right. Most of your life can be out of sight. Withdraw from the darkness and look to the light.